Excellent.
Good evening, guys. We'll just let it catch up as always. Here we go, go, go. Good evening.
Evening.
We are live. Great. Good evening, guys. Welcome to Series 3, Episode 3 of The Accidental Journalist, Live and Undrugged. As always, I want to thank my sponsors, Mr. James Jeffries and Miss Charlie Farrington, without whom I wouldn't be able to pay my Zoom bill. So I'm eternally grateful for that because they enable me to do this. Tonight, I am with Darren Barden. I've known Darren for a good couple of years now. We've been friends on Facebook for a good couple of years, and he's been one of my biggest supporters, I have to say. You know, and he's supported me in so many ways, and not just financially, you know, emotionally and mentally. So, you know, as always, thank you for that, mate.
No problem. Thank you.
Let's take you back to the start of your journey, mate.
Well, I mean, normal upbringing. Yeah, I mean, Dad was a lorry driver. Mum was a school dinner lady. So, you know, from that point of view, everything was normal. You know, we had no money. You know, my mum and dad were working all hours. Me and my sister had to sort of get ourselves up in the mornings, get ourselves to school, you know, just purely because my mum and dad had to work so much. So, but, you know, it was a loving household, normal, just a run-of-the-mill, normal, you know, mum and dad, two kids just growing up in a council house. Eventually, mum and dad got the opportunity to buy the council house when I was considerably older, into my teens. But yeah, it was just fun, you know, playing out all the time, doing all the things that boys do, you know. Some of your viewers may recognise the phrase, you know, knock down ginger. We've done a bit of that when we was kids, you know, knocking on doors, running away. It was as mad as it got, you know. We used to do something called runouts, you know, so you'd all have to get back to a base without being caught. And it was just fun. My whole childhood was, well, as far as I'm concerned, was a good, decent childhood, you know. So then I got into my teens and then started work. I started an apprenticeship, which was back then called a YTS, which was the youth training scheme, I think it was called, which was aimed just, you know, for people like me. I weren't going to go to college. I wasn't going to go to university, you know. So I've never been academic in any way, shape or form. I mean, I'm not silly, but at the same time, I wasn't. I love school. I actually really enjoyed school. But I had trouble with authority at school. but that weren't the school's fault. That was my fault. You know, so, yeah, so I got into an apprenticeship. You know, I was on £28 a week. And it was a decent wage back then, you know. So it got me a couple of points. And, yeah, I was happy, you know. I met the love of my life, Wendy. We're still married, 30 now, 30-odd years on. So I think we've been together 36 years now, maybe, something like that, 34. I can't remember how many years now, but hopefully she can't hear downstairs, so otherwise I'll be getting a bit of a rollicking now. Yeah, and in life, just, you know, it was fine. We moved out to New Zealand and Australia. I had a job opportunity come up in New Zealand. So we went out with the intention of just testing the water in New Zealand and Australia to see if we liked either of them. I sort of went with the idea, I thought if I liked one, I'd stay. Wendy always went with the idea that actually she wanted to do the 12 months and then we'll come back and then go at a later date permanently. You know, she would miss her mum and dad and so on. So we came back. And then we then had a baby. We bought a house, had a baby, George, who's now 27. But when he was 1 year old, that's when the world changed, you know, for me, completely changed, and dramatically. So I had a normal day job where I used to go work during the day, van driving at the time. And then I also used to do a job at night delivering newspapers to shops. So in a van, just used to drive around the shops at, you know, between midnight and 3 or 4 in the morning just to sort of earn an extra few quid because we were skint. You know, I was trying to bring up the young family. And yeah, it was hard work. It was very hard work. But then one Monday night at midnight, now, bearing in mind, you've got to go back to the days where we didn't have mobile phones. You know, Zoom, as we're on now, just wouldn't have even been thought of, you know. So the world's changed dramatically since then. But yeah, so if one of us had overslept, you know, hadn't turned up for work, we'd generally phone the home line, or we'd go round and knock on the door, say, listen, you know, you're late. And bearing in mind, all the blokes in this place were just, we were doing it because we were skinny. It's not the sort of job you do for fun, you know. So you're all skinny, and it's just really a case of, you know, just earning as much as you can to get by every week. So anyway, if one of us was late, like I say, someone would go around and knock. So on a Monday night at midnight, I was due to start work, I think around 1 o'clock in the morning. So I've been asleep since seven. I'm in bed since seven. My wife was up with me then 1-year-old son in the other room. He was teething. So she was trying to keep him quiet, obviously, because I needed to sleep because I had to be up at 1 in the morning. So getting a knock on the door at midnight, I just suddenly got startled and thought, I've overslept. So I just wearing my pants, like, you know, so I run downstairs. And as I've gone down the stairs and opened the door, there was two guys stood in front of me. And as I looked out to the right, the one standing to the right of me, he looked beyond the one on the left up the alleyway and just nodded. And the next thing I remember, I sort of got my hands out in front of me and I could just feel my head being bad. You know, this is it. There was no words spoken, you know, no conversation, no one asking me who I was or anything like that. And then I went from this position, hands outstretched in front of me, and I can't tell you exactly what happened because I don't know if I blacked out or was knocked out. But I was sat on the floor, sort of in a fetal position like this, you know, trying to protect my head, and I could just feel my head being bad from side to side, side to side. And I didn't feel anything happening to my body, but I could just feel my head going backwards and forwards, like I was just being hit on the head. Once again, I couldn't tell you whether it went on for 30 seconds or 3 minutes. I haven't got a clue, you know, all these years on. I don't know. I don't know what that was then. So, but all of a sudden it stopped. It just stopped. And I just remember that all I can see in my memory is their jackets and their jeans. I've got no recollection of their face or their shoes. But in my mind, you know, on a TV program where they blur it out, you know, they put that blur over someone's face. Well, it's like that on their shoes and their face in my memory. And I still, to this day, that is all it is, you know. So I would never, ever, ever have a clue who they are at all. But it just stopped. It just literally stopped. And they just walked away. You know, they just turned and walked out of the house. And bearing in mind, this is all happening just inside my front door. Bearing in mind, my wife's upstairs with a 1-year-old son. She can hear screaming, you know, help, police, stop, all that sort of stuff, everything frantic screaming. She thought some nutcase had knocked on my door and was screaming at me, as opposed to it being me that was doing the screaming. So she was just hiding in fear upstairs. I don't know how I shut my front door when they left. I don't know what I've done in my hands or my feet. But I do know then I crawled through my, I only had a short hallway, a small house, you know, short hallway. I crawled through that, and in using the sort of settee and dragging myself through the living room, I mean, the blood was pouring out of me. You know, I had wounds in my head, back, chest and legs, you know, so there was blood just pouring everywhere. I made it to the telephone, which for some of the younger people, if they're listening, you know, there's an old thing with a cable on it, you know, so, and I done 999, you know. It was at that point when my wife heard me, I was asking for everybody, police, ambulance, fire, you send them, like, you know, I didn't know what I was doing. And she suddenly realised, hang on, that was Darren that was making the screams, you know. So it was quite horrendous for Wendy. Obviously, it was horrendous for me. I lived it. But, you know, she could just hear all this but not witness anything going on. And eventually she's got a 1-year-old in her arms. She comes down the stairs and just sees me sitting on the floor, bleeding to death, basically. I just sat there cross-legged and just basically waiting for either, number one, as I felt at the time, either waiting to die or an ambulance to save me, you know. Once she see me, you know, the screams were horrendous, you know, because obviously now I'm just sitting there with blood pouring out all over my body. She came through, she went in the kitchen and got a tea towel, just touched my head, and it was just soaked, like, you know, so that went, got thrown away immediately. It done no good whatsoever. There's so much blood coming out of me. And she just sat on the settee, the sofa there, you know, with a 1-year-old in her arms. And we just waited, we just waited. And then there was this banging on the door. And it turns out a couple of my neighbours had heard the screaming and sort of whatever had gone on. And then once it had died down, they then decided to come and knock to see if we was okay. But we didn't know it was them. So Wendy just screamed at them to go away. Bearing in mind, she thought she was screaming at the attackers again.
Yeah.
You know, so, but obviously they tried, you know what I mean? The neighbours tried. But yeah, then we just sat there and it was sort of a funny moment where, because I was like sitting like this, trying to keep the blood from pouring in my eyes, you know, because I've got blood pumping out of my skull. My one-year-old son, George, he was like, he thought I was playing peekaboo. So he's sitting there going like, boo, like this, like, you know, and I found myself with blood pouring out of my head going, boo, you know, it was a surreal moment. But then there was this really loud knocking at the door and the police started arriving and it was frantic. I mean, it was literally, I just sat there and it was like this whole world was going in fast forward around me. And all I could hear was people going, Darren, what do you know about a red car? Darren, what do you know about a red sports car? Darren. And every time they asked me a question, and I didn't know anything about a red sports car, anything at all. And it turned out there was an eyewitness who had sort of seen and heard on. And he went and done 999, but he also see a getaway car drive away. And he reported it being a red sports car. So I was... I'm cold. It's a cold I've never ever felt in my life, you know. So yeah, absolutely freezing. Then somehow the ambulance guys then turned up. But prior to that, even prior to the police getting there, I think I decided I needed to speak to my mum and dad. So I've got blood pouring out of me. I went to pick the phone up. And anyway, the operator was still there because it was a 999 call and it hadn't been resolved. They were still there. And anyway, I said, look, I need to phone my dad. And they said, well, you've got to put the phone down, count to 10, pick the phone back up and dial the number you want. Now, I don't know how I'd done that, but I did. And I just said to my dad, he answered, bearing in mind this is now after midnight as well, I said to my dad, look, can you come round? I've been beat up. Because at this point, I didn't know I'd been stabbed. Mm. You know, I had no clue. I just thought I'd been beat up. And so then the police come. We had all the kerfuffle with the police, everything going on. You know, it was just absolutely mental. Then they took Wendy and George upstairs. And then my mum and dad turned up, you know, before the ambulance, bearing in mind. Like, this is, they think they got problems now. This was a Monday night at midnight. You know what I mean? There's hardly a lot going on with people being thrown out of clubs or anything on a Monday night. So, the ambulance guys, I mean, they were brilliant, absolutely brilliant. But so my mum and dad turned up. There was blue and white tape all around the property. And like they were going to stop my mum coming in. Like, and obviously, a mother coming through a blue and white bit of tape isn't going to stop her, like, you know. So no mum stopping there. Eventually, they let her in. But all they got to see was me sitting there in the other end of the living room with blood pouring out of me. And the police just ushered my mum and dad straight upstairs with Wendy and George. And then we just waited, and the ambulance guys then turned up. And it was full on then trying to stop me bleeding, bandaging me up, getting me prepped. Then they put me on this metal chair, this frame, put some blankets around me because I was so cold. And then, yeah, they started to wheel me out. And as they were wheeling me out, at the bottom of my stairs, what I thought was a little baby, like a miniature cricket bat, was an 18-inch meat cleaver in a cardboard and cling film holster. Now, it hadn't been used on me, which is fortunate, but they'd obviously dropped it and left it behind. But it's that point, when I see that, I then realise I'd been stabbed, you know, and with quite a few swear words and things like that, I was like, I've been stabbed, you know. And then suddenly I realised what had gone on. And as they wheeled me out of the house, and the ambulance was about, I don't know, 10 yards away, 15 yards away. I can always remember, like, it's October the 7th, midnight, so it could be October the 8th type thing. I don't know exactly what side of it happened. But yeah, as they wheeled me out, I looked to the sky and it was just crystal clear. You know, it was just full of stars. It was this I call it midnight blue, and it was just a beautiful colour blue. But it was that moment, I thought that was my last breath. I thought I'd gone, you know, I hadn't got in the ambulance at this point. I was just looking up, and I just thought I was dead. You know, that was me over with, you know. Then they put me in the back of an ambulance with a police officer and Wendy, and then off we went in the ambulance, you know. And fortunately enough, now when I look back on that moment, I have a little smile, because it wasn't the moment I died, you know. So I beat that one. But yeah, so we're in the ambulance and we're driving along, and I was like, I've never been in an ambulance before, you know, in my life. And suddenly, and bearing in mind, this is just what I've been told, but apparently I kept going like, you know, have we got the sirens on? Have we got the lights on? You know, anyway, apparently the ambulance driver shouted back, tell him we've gone through a red light. That might keep him quiet, like, you know. So, yeah, so we got to the hospital, but then it sort of, there's large chunks. I can't remember what happened. You know, I can't, there's bits and pieces I can remember, but I can't remember all of it. And I remember being laying face down or leaning. I don't know if I was laying or they were bending me over, but into a trough, and they were just trying to shower the blood from my hair, because it was still bleeding. Because I had 7 serious stab wounds in my skull. But each one of those stab wounds, it looked like they'd just been stabbing in the same place more than once. So they were trying to find the wounds so they could stitch them up, but it wouldn't stop bleeding. Like, you know, so that was just obviously in my head. The one in my back, you could put your whole hand in that. You know, that's what they told me. You could actually put your whole hand in that. I had them on my knees, across my chest. One of the stab wounds across my chest was, lucky enough, it was more of a scratch than a stab, but they take a Stanley knife and they put 2 blades in it and they separate with a match. I learned this from the police, obviously, afterwards, and that's what they cut me across the chest with that. But lucky enough, it just scratched, and then right at the end, it just dug in and they broke the Stanley blade off in my chest, the actual bit of the knife, but it didn't do too much damage on that one. But yeah, I just had slashes up my legs, stab wounds to my kneecaps, like in the side of my knees. Yeah, it was just all over my body, basically, you know. So then they were still asking me questions, you know, why are you getting stitched up and things like this? And there were some really lovely nurses in there. I can remember one of them, I'm laying there and it has putting the stitches in my head, going, oh, you know, you can get compensation for this. I was like, oh, I don't know what day of the week it is at this point, like, you know. But what she was trying to say was there's support out there, you know. So, you know, she was doing it in all good faith, you know. But, yeah, so they stitched me up. They then put me in this little isolated room. I had an armed police officer with me at the time, and my dad turned up. And, yeah, we just sat there waiting. They had a few issues because I had blood. One of my pupils was either, I don't know what you call it, getting bigger, getting smaller, dilating or not dilating enough. But they thought there might have been some blood dropping on the back of my eyeball at one point inside. So they were a bit worried about that side of things. And then they put me in this ward, right? So I was in this ward and I was just sitting there. And like I say, I really don't know what I was thinking. I'm just laying there. You know, this has all been, you know, it's an eventful evening. So all of a sudden, a team of nurses, doctors, whatever they were, police, just came in, surrounded me, whipped me off this bed, threw me onto a trolley and wheeled me out. And apparently they'd seen a prowler in the hospital and they just thought someone had come to finish the job, you know. So, yeah, it turns out the prowler was just someone from one of the local wards who was just wandering around the hospital, but they didn't know that at the time. So they wheeled me off and stuck me in the corner. I was in this little ward with 5 old girls. And there's all sorts of stuff, you know, going through your head. But I just didn't really know what was happening. You know, one of the porters had come down to be nosy, because obviously the news went round the hospital like wildfire. And I always remember it because his name was Jim Reeves, this guy. And I see him come into the little ward and he started... So he spoke to the, I don't know what you call them, the sort of the nurse at the front. And he pointed at me and he started walking towards me. And as he got closer, I remember looking, he's in a nice clean boiler suit. And he had very nice clean polished shoes. And it was like a film. And he's just walking towards me. Now, I'm thinking to myself, he's come to finish me off. And as he got near me, I sort of, I don't know, I think I threw myself off the bed or whatever it was. And all it was, he just came to be nosy, like, you know what I mean? So, and I know the guy actually carried on working at a hospital for years after. My mum worked there, so she'd spoke to him about the story, and, you know, so we had a bit of a giggle about it later on in life. But yeah, it was a strange night, you know. So I was in a hospital literally until, so that was a Monday night. By Tuesday afternoon, they were ready to send me home. My brother-in-law, Pete, he come up to pick me up, helped me get dressed, and then drove me back to my mum and dad's. And then it was sort of that point, really, that's when the world really changed. Because at this point, I don't know what's going on. You know, it's just everything. There's so many things that have happened. And I was aware, obviously, that I've been stabbed. But, you know, I couldn't recollect everything that was happening. You know, people were talking to you. People were then coming around and seeing you. I just didn't really take it all on board. But then as the days and the weeks then passed from there, I was in a state of shock. I went into a bout of depression very quickly. They put me in front of counsellors, psychiatrists. But there was something inside me needed to get back to normal. But I was also fighting that as well. And I sat down with a doctor one day, and he said, Darren, he said, I've been your doctor for many years. I've been your family's doctor for many years. He said, what you need to do is go back to work. You know, that's what you need to do. Your family's a family of workers. So he said, you'll start feeling better. And sure enough, I did. Went back to work, and it just sort of went to normal life very quickly. I hadn't dealt with anything. You know, I hadn't dealt with, you know, I mean, you understand this part, Jack. You know, it's. I just sort of went, right, okay, then I've got a young son at home. I've got a wife to fend for. Sort of, you know, my stitches were out. I was healing, like physically I was healing, but I just had to get back to work and pay my bills. You know, so the mortgage company at the time were horrendous at first to deal with. They didn't care. You know, they really, and the things were different. They're different now, you know, but they just did not care at all. Anyway, via victim support, who were brilliant. Ronnie Ayres, who worked, she was the victim support coordinator, wonderful woman. So she helped, and eventually, through the power that the victim support have, I ended up, they gave me my mortgage for £1 a month until I was ready, which was great. But it was a battle to get that far, I tell you. You know, you don't realise sometimes in the event of a trauma, the knock-on effect.
No.
You know, whether, you know, it could be a car crash. It could be, you know, in my case, you know, victim of a brutal stabbing. It's other people's perception of it is really strange. You know, you'd think you'd go to a company and go, listen, I've had a brutal stabbing, 20-odd stab wounds. I'm out of work, still suffering mentally. You'd sort of expect a bit of compassion straight away, but it's not always there. You know, and that's a battle. And I was always looking for someone to blame for it, because I had no one to blame. I didn't know why it happened. You know, we eventually started establishing it was mistaken identity. It was a professional hit, apparently. Not very professional. Obviously, they got the wrong house or wrong bloke or both. So I think if word got out, they won't get much work again, will they? But, you know, so, I started going into struggles with life in general, you know, whether it be financial, mentally, but I didn't really know, and I was just burying it all in the back of the mind, like, you know. So, you know, we went through life normally. A couple of years later, we had another child, my daughter Shannon, and life was sort of normal. You know, there was we just carried on. You know, I was doing all the things I thought I was going to do, whether it be business or work or, you know, playing a bit of golf. But I hadn't dealt with any of it, you know. And that's probably the worst mistake I made. You know, I didn't take the counselling serious. You know, I didn't take the psychiatrist serious. You know, I just thought, I'll go and see him because it'll help me with the compensation claim, you know. And the compensation from the criminal injuries compensation board was a complete farce. You know, that was, I think, probably one of the worst things I had to go through was dealing with them. They were incredibly heartless. And just the whole dealing with them it took nearly 2 years, you know, and eventually I think I ended up with, they gave me £2,000 as an interim payment. And I think after 2 years, I eventually got about another $5,000, I think. So I ended up with $7,500. But it wasn't about the money. I mean, I needed it. I desperately needed the time, but there was three categories. There was this $2,000, $7,500, and then $20,000. And as much as the money would be nice, or would have been nice at the time, the $20,000 for me wasn't about the money. It was about the acknowledgement that some crap had, you know, happened to me. So that was the hard part, you know, that battle to end up 2 years in, $7,500. You know, I lost over $8,000 in wages back then. You know, bearing in mind the dates we're talking about 20 odd years ago, you know, it was so bad. But, you know, I moved on again. I carried on. I started doing charity work myself. But we think about 13 years on from the actual stabbing, is when I started slipping into a bout of depression. Now, these days we know it's PTSD. Yeah. Back then, I didn't know that. I'd never heard of PTSD before. You know, that weren't a thing for me. However, it was a very real situation. And because I'd sort of moved on in life, I had this bit of space somewhere in the front of the head, and what I'd bottled up from years before came to the fore. So what then started to happen was this bout of depression just got worse and worse and worse. I was being vile to the people I loved. You know, when I say vile, you know, just like miserable and horrible, you know, saying bad things, you know, nothing physical, nothing, not real verbal abuse, but just not a nice person to be with, you know. And it, you know, for that went on for quite a while. You know, I couldn't tell you exactly how long, you know, there's no dates to it. But it culminated in, I was in a bar, I was out with my wife's work friends, and I was in a bar, and we'd had a nice night, and something happened in the bar. Bearing in mind, you know, I'm not a fighting person, I don't fight people, but something happened. This guy sort of pushed my wife over, and that was my little button. I see the red mist come down, and bearing in mind, I can't fight, so where I thought I was beating the guy up, I probably weren't even hitting him, like, you know. So, but yeah, it's just, you know, I mean, that for my wife, bearing in mind she'd been tolerating for years my slip into depression, that was a little moment. That was I've had enough of this, you know. So she never spoke to me for a couple of days. It actually wasn't my fault, and someone else had witnessed the fact it wasn't my fault, but my wife didn't know that at the time, like Wendy didn't know that. So it was that was probably one of the low points, you know, because I weren't in control of me. I weren't in control of my emotions. I weren't in control of, you know, my thought process. You know, because I weren't a nice person, I then started thinking that, you know, actually people don't really care about you. They don't like you. And then you go through that stage with depression where, you know, no one really cares about you. Now they do. You know, this is going on in my head. You know, they do. But I was surplus to requirements. You know, no one was going to worry if I wasn't around anymore. No one cared, you know. And like I say, this is so far from the truth. Lots and lots of people care, which is why I'm still here today, you know. But I nearly wasn't, you know. And I'd worked it all out. I'd worked out that through this sort of depression, that I was going to take my own life. And I didn't know how I was going to take my own life, but I knew I was going to end my life. And I then started to plan what would happen in the event of me not being around, you know, in my eventual demise. I then just decided, right, okay, then Wendy's going to go back to work after 2 weeks. The kids are going to go and do this after 3 weeks. Then there was some people in my world. I decided in my head that actually they were going to muscle in on Wendy. So I then developed this hatred of these people. I mean, passionately hate these people. These guys hadn't done anything. They're not even really in our world. It was just all going on in my head. And I would try and make myself get in a situation where I could watch them. And I was making stuff up all along. You know, it wasn't that long ago, actually. A few years ago when I was diagnosed with something called catastrophic thinking. So I literally would make a scenario up and then the outcome as well. Mm-hmm. And it was sort of that part, I think, stopped me taking my own life. So this strange act of hatred for these people to stop them moving in, you know, on Wendy, it was like, right, I'm gonna stick around here, make sure it doesn't happen, like, you know. So I think inadvertently that's what probably saved me in a way. But yeah, then listen, I was clearly in a state, you know. It was a big step to go to the doctors and say, listen, you know, I'm nuts here. I'm not, you know, something wrong with me. I knew there was something wrong with me. And that was a massive, massive day. The day I had the doctor's appointment was a huge, huge day. It was a bit embarrassing. I got in there. There was a trainee doctor in the room. I swore and shouted at the doctors. I made them swap seats. You know, I kept phoning the doctors up to apologise so many times, just because I was so out of order. And then the doctor said, look, you know, you need to speak to this charity called Mind. And I was like, okay, then. He said, here's a phone number. So I thought, what? And that was what I got. That's what I got from the doctors at the time. The first visit was, there you go. Here's a phone number. Go and phone them and they'll help you out. I didn't really know what Mind was as a charity. Well, I didn't have a clue. So I phoned this number thinking someone was going to answer. I'd chat to them. We'd go for a meeting and we'd sort it out. It was an answer phone message. And I mean, I don't know how Mind operate now, but I'm going back quite a few years. And yeah, so it was an answer phone. The answer phone basically said, you know, we're busy or, you know, closed, whatever it was, but you can go online. So I thought, right. So I got the computer and sat at a dining table and went on to Mind on the internet and started to fill this form in, right? So, and it asked you questions, you know, about how many times you think like this, how many times do you feel like this? And I went through the whole thing. I was crying my eyes out, you know, I was sobbing my eye because I'm basically telling this computer via form filling my innermost feelings. Like I was sitting there on my own, and at the end of it, this little box popped up, said, we're really concerned about your welfare. Someone will be in touch. You know, 7 years on, no one's ever got back to me. So actually, it's longer than that. It's about 9 years on. No one's ever got back to me. But it was after that I realised that it was a charity and they were underfunded, undermanned, you know. So, but it was horrendous at the time. You know, I literally sat by that phone waiting for a call from someone to come and save me and no one did. You know, and when that little pop-up screen came up and said, we're really concerned about your welfare, someone will be in touch, that was like a hand out to me saying, listen, we're coming for you, we're going to save you. And it never did. You know, so the depression then just got worse and worse, because if the charity that's meant to help you don't care, which I know they do, so this is just going on in my head, you know, if the charity's there, they don't care. No one cared. The doctor didn't care. He just sent me, gave me a phone number and sent me away. The internet told me they don't care. You know, suddenly then the depression got worse and worse. You know, and I was on this downward spiral and, I was on the verge of destruction, self-destruction, and it's not a nice place to be. You know, so that's why some of the stuff, and I'll get onto that in a bit, what I do now. But at that point, no one knew. The only one who was living this nightmare with me was my wife, Wendy. And we were shielding the kids from it. Wendy done a fantastic job. The kids were growing up, you know. She was shielding them the whole time from this, what was going on. You know, me sitting on the, you know, on the front row carpet, sobbing my heart out, you know, going to bed crying, you know, or going to bed not sleeping, you know, just walking around the house. You know, there's times when we had a coffee table. We used to go downstairs into the living room and just walk round and round and round this coffee table. And so fast, sometimes I was sort of like leaning like a motorbike would, you know, just going round. I was loopy, like, you know, for a while. So, and she lived for all of that, you know, all the time. She's bringing up the kids, holding a job down, keeping the house going. And I was just buried in my own self-pity and, you know, thinking no one cared. And that was... Obviously, it's over a period of time, but probably the worst thing ever, you know, the depression. I will say this on possibly every interview I do, that if I was given the choice now of have the stabbing or go through the depression, you could stab me all day long. I would not, the depression, and, you know, unfortunately now, society, people ban the word around depressed far too often. So it's not taken as seriously as it should be. It is an illness. You know, and people like the situation I was in, that's real. That's very real for a lot of people. You know, we can all get a bit cheesed off and, you know, down and things like that at times, but that's not depression. You know, and when I've heard it myself, in, you know, whether it be in the workplace or where family members, friends go, I'm right depressed, like, you know, and I'm thinking, well, I don't think you are, you know, but because the word's just easily used. It's like they just make an extreme, you know, like, I think, you know, the word awesome, you know, everyone says everything's awesome when actually, when, you know, when you come across something that's actually awesome, I don't know what word you're going to use, you know. So, and I think depression does the opposite of that. It's like, it's, I want to make it sound really bad, so I'll use the word depression. And it's, you know, it's a bad situation for a lot of people. But eventually I got on the tablets, Cetraline, 50 milligrams of Cetraline. And I know they call it the placebo effect, but the moment I took the first tablet, I felt better. You know, I started to feel better. And there's two sort of turning points for me. It was Boxing Day, and I was around my mother and father-in-law's house, and my wife, my daughter, and my mother-in-law had gone into the kitchen. I sat there with my father-in-law, and he'd had a bit of a cough for about 3 or 4 weeks. This is all pre-COVID, by the way, so, you know, different reaction then. Yeah, he just said to me, he said, look, they don't prepare you for this in old age, you know, getting ill. So, and I looked at him, and it was like he was telling me something. And then the penny dropped, you know, without him saying anything or actually saying the words. He was saying to me, you know, if anything happens to him, I've got to look after his daughter. And that was a real turning point for me. It was like, no, hold on, I need to get my stuff together. You know what I mean? I really do. Because if anything did happen to him, I needed to be able to look after her. And I couldn't even look after myself. So in the meantime, so that was Boxing Day. And there's a real turning point for me. Now, the tablets I'd had have been kicking around for about 6 or 7 weeks. I hadn't taken them. And I didn't want to take them because I felt that mental health had beat me. If I took the tablets, I'd lost the game. But I desperately needed them. But I was refusing. They get moving around the house, different places. So then I had this moment on Boxing Day. And then my friends were coming down. Stuart and Rachel were coming down from Yorkshire to come and see us because obviously I'd been in a bad way mentally. And I thought to myself, actually, you know what? I need to take these tablets so I can't be like I am when my friends are here. You know, they're the greatest friends ever. You know, we've been friends for 30 odd years. So with my father-in-law's little message and my friends coming down, I took the first tablet and I just sat there and cried my eyes out because for a brief moment, I'd lost this bloody battle, you know, this thing called depression. So, but what happened then was like, I've taken the tablet now and suddenly I feel, actually, you know what? I feel better. I did. You know, I wasn't, clearly. You know, it don't work that quick. It takes a couple of months. But, and that's why I say about the placebo effect, because I made that first step.
Yeah.
Every step after that was better and better and better. You know, listen, it's never going to go away fully. There's still some dark moments, you know, but right now I'm in the best place I've been in 20 odd years, you know, mentally. I'm on top of my game. I'm enjoying life. You know, we're doing okay for ourselves financially, you know, so the kids are doing great. You know, both got good jobs, both work hard. Wendy's got a good job. You know, we're surrounded by good people. So it's all come together nicely. You know, my parents, Wendy's parents are doing well. You know, so from that side of things, it's brilliant. And then, but just rewind a little bit back about whether it was now 5 or 7 years ago, I got the job I got now with a company called Hilti. And Hilti have been brilliant. You know, when I found the company, I didn't realise there was companies out there that could be as good as they were. Mm-hmm. And because I then started to enjoy my life a little bit, that's when I got to write the book. So upon writing the book, I didn't know what I was doing. I'm not, you know, as I said earlier, I'm not an academic person. I didn't really know what I was doing with it. I just poured my heart out onto paper, you know, and that's all I did. I just put everything down and we put it out there and I became a best-selling author because of it, which was brilliant. So, you know, it was fantastic. But then what happened was, my book and my story, not me, it wasn't me, it's just the fact that I was a bloke that just went, sometimes life can be a bit rubbish. Yeah. People started to listen and it started to inspire other people. And the story inspired other people. You know, it wasn't me, I wasn't doing the inspiration, it was a story. And I think inadvertently, it was probably Wendy that was the inspiration for all of it. You know, she was the one that was really inspiring people because of her strength, you know, to number one, bring up a family, but also coach me through, you know, 15 years of probably hell, you know, as it was then. And so then the book started really helping people. And that's when I started thinking, oh, I could do more of this. The reward's great. You know, when you help people, you can't beat that feeling. You know, this is not someone paying you for help. This is just doing it because you enjoy it. Yeah. And, you know, and I've got several stories of, you know, life-saving moments for some people who were on the brink of suicide, who read the book or spoke to me, and then they didn't take their own lives. They actually then carried on with their nice lives, you know. So that's, you know, you can't put a price on that stuff. And that's what I enjoy now. You know, more than anything else is helping other people. And I've dabbled with it, as you know, you said earlier, you know, with the knife crime, you know, the knife crime, a guy called Ben Spanner, you probably know, who created that, the charity, you know, put down your, change your life, put down your knife. Fantastic initiative. You know, it's a brilliant charity. He's got momentum. He had a mission, and he was fantastic. He came to me for a bit of support. I supported it and put a lot of work into it at the time. But I found my voice wasn't being heard in that sphere. You know, it wasn't. I think, unfortunately, with knife crime, we picture inner city gangs.
Yes.
You know, I think that's what when we hear knife crime, we think of, you know, young lads stabbing each other on the streets of a city. And although mine was a knife crime, here I am, a middle-aged bloke, you know, living out in Essex near the country, trying to tell people, put down your knife. They weren't listening to me, and probably rightly so. You know, what do I know about their world? The only thing I really knew was the fact I'd been on the wrong end of knife crime. I found my voice wasn't really being heard. You know, the charity is fantastic, and it's still going, and Ben's doing a great job. And, you know, and he's got some great support around him, and I wish them all the best. But it wasn't for me. I think my world, my mission needed to be to work with mental health.
Same.
You know, and yeah, and, you know, listen, I'm not a doctor. I'm not a psychiatrist. I'm not trained. You know, everything I do when I stand up in front of people and help, it's through my lived in experience. You know, now whether that's good, bad, or indifferent, I don't know. It's just how I feel. And I've not heard of any bad results because of the stuff I've done. So I'm hoping it's good for people, you know, and it helps people out. And now I'm taking that to a new level. So I've created an online training course for salespeople. But it's sort of sales training that will actually help with the on-the-job mental health. And also, it's really targeting the construction industry as well, the industry that I work in. I want to help these guys, you know, because I know the industry. And in particular, my part of the industry is the tall hire industry. And I feel I can be of good use. You know, you can't. I struggled a bit a few years ago because I think I was trying to save everybody. And you can't, you know, we just can't do it, you know. So if we can do our little bit in our little worlds, you know, and if there's enough of us, we can all make a difference. So that's why I'm choosing the industry I work in, you know, to try and help them. And hopefully all this gets launched over the coming months and, you know, we can do some good, you know, for a lot of people. And that's where I'm at the moment. Like, I mean, like I say, the best form I've ever been in mentally. You know, I'm working hard. I'm enjoying my work. I'm enjoying the work I do outside of my day job. And it's, yeah, life at the moment is where it needs to be. Absolutely does. So I think I've been talking for a long time now, mate, boring you to death there.
Far from it, mate. Far from it.
That's the Darren Barden story.
Yeah, and such an amazing story, an inspiring story it is, mate. I can identify so much with, you know, I've been stabbed a couple of times, not to the degree of you.
Yeah.
I know it hurt. You know, I wanted to help the change of life, you know, and Ben Spann, and I had him on sort of pre the accidental journalist when we were still Shed X.
Yeah.
I think it was the third episode. But I don't feel that I was being heard in there, you know, as well, just like you. So I feel that I can do better talking about mental health and addiction and, you know, coping with near-death experiences and things like that, because yeah, that's what I know. And it's only, what, 8 years for me?
Yeah.
You know, since it all kicked off and I ended up on my deathbed. But I can identify with the, when you were talking about trauma so much, I can identify with the way that it just, it makes your head sort of, my wife describes it as busy.
Yeah, definitely.
And the way that we, at the start, we bonded to that trauma, and that trauma is a part of us, and it still is to a certain extent. And I don't think that we ever really move on from trauma, but we move forward.
Yeah.
Just like we do with grief. Because it's the same sort of thing. We're grieving for that situation, for that person that it happened to. And it kind of detaches, doesn't it? And you kind of don't see it as you for a little while.
And someone said to me, it's a guy called, guy who does training courses, Dean Graziosi, and he uses the phrase that, you know, he talks about it in very different things, whether it be relationships or business, whatever it is, but it's quite apt for what we're talking about, is that, you know, whatever's gone on in our world, for far too often for me, it was like being in a ship, and that was the anchor.
Yeah.
And it weren't the anchor to hold me still and stable, it was the anchor that was holding me back.
Yes.
And now what it is, it's actually the same thing. So still the stabbing, it's still the mental health, but it's now the wind in my sails.
Yes.
It's now the thing that's driving me. And I'm using the same story, the same scenario, but as opposed to it holding me back, it's now helped me move forward. And that's where the great thing is.
Yeah, because we stop using it. You say that you're in the tool industry. And I think that... retrospect is one of the greatest tools in our personal arsenal, really. And we can use it as an education. Once I decided that I was going to use my story to educate others, that's when I started to be able to start growing as a person, start working on my own trauma, and start just pushing out and building up that confidence. And it's not always easy.
No.
The self-confidence takes a knock every now and again, and we get knocked down a peg or two, but that's why I do this. I've always said from the start that it's not Live and Undrugged isn't exclusively my platform. It's a platform for people to have a voice, because as a northern man, I was marginalized.
Yeah.
As a northern man living in the east, I was marginalized. As as a man and as homeless, I was marginalized. As an addict, I was marginalized. And I didn't know how to use my voice.
Yeah.
It was all the poor me, poor me, poor me, poor me, poor me, poor me, poor me. And that's where it sort of, when I spoke to Jason Edwards, who helped me start this whole journey, that's when I realized that, that drive that I had to get those drugs, that drive that I had to do what I needed to do to get through the day, that drive that I had to walk 14 miles a day just to have a relationship with my daughter and also be able to function as a person and as an addict, I needed to put that into this. And I don't always do that. And, with best intentions, I've wanted to write another book for years and just, 2017, I wrote the second book, and then 2019, 20, we did the Paul Massey book. And I've had works in progress, and I've just not been able to mentally get there.
Yeah.
And it's because I guess I had this underlined trauma bonding.
Yeah, and you still probably, like I say, I feel like I'm probably a couple of years ahead of you in some ways, where you know, it's still possibly somewhere in there, you know, it's holding you back a bit. You know, it's almost like you can't be doing good and you can't be enjoying life because you're starting to feel guilty about the old you, you know, realizing actually, no, I need to feel sorry for myself, you know, and you don't. You know, what you're doing on here, you know, the people you get on here, is get, like you say, it's a platform for people like me to tell me story. But it's, you know, with us, with me now, me to tell my story, it's not about everyone have a look at Darren Bardon. It's actually, listen, take what I've got and use that to go and change your world. You know, if I can impact people's lives by sharing my story, then it's, you know, in strange ways, it's been worth it.
Yeah.
You know, and I think the same with yourself. You know, you've got that, you've got an opportunity now. You've got the platform, you know, yeah. And by doing good, and you know full well, you know, with the work you do, that when you do help people, it is so rewarding. And that's the driving force now. You know, that can I impact people's lives? Can I change their worlds for the good by using the rubbish that happened to me in the past?
Yeah. I started the Council of Survivors Voices on Facebook for that exact reason. And I probably don't put as much in there as I should. But, you know, what you said there about guilt and shame, I did have a lot of that, survivor's guilt. And, you know, I've learned to deal with that now. You know, I'm a man of God. So I, you know, I know that guilt and shame has been taken away.
Yeah.
Although it's kind of like when you hurt yourself and you get a pain, or you get a toothache and you get a pain, and that pain's gone, but it's only just gone. So you find yourself, choking just to, you know, it's kind of like that for me.
Yeah. It's for me. I'm channeling my energy now into, you know, this helping people. I just recently won an award. That cup you can see behind me there. I won the Legacy Cup at work, which is, you know, an absolute honour. You know, this is people acknowledging you for stuff I do naturally. Mm. But then it's actually being recognised, and actually to have an organisation that employs, you know, just in the UK, 1,000 people, acknowledging some of the good that I do and the lives I impact. And that's a brilliant thing. And that now, when you realise the driving force is doing good, you know, and I know you're a man of God, and I'm not particularly religious, but I know by helping others and doing good, that's just the greatest reward for me. And that really has changed my perspective, because I used to look at things in, not as in what will I get out of it, but not as in financially, but more emotionally. And it was almost like an ulterior motive for doing something, you know, whereas actually there was nothing there to gain. But it was like I felt like I needed to get something out of it, whether it's acknowledgement, whether it was, you know, a pat on the back. Whereas now I do it because it does make me feel good doing it, not the after effect of someone, you know, saying, well done. I just enjoy doing it. And that side of things has really changed for me. It's changed my personality, I believe, you know, into more, I think I'm more compassionate with other people's issues, you know, close to me. So, yeah, it's you know, we're on a journey, mate. We're going to be on a journey for a while, you know. Mine feels like, instead of being uphill now, it feels like it's on the downhill. So I've got a bit of wind behind me, and we're away, like, you know.
Yeah. It's I don't know. I guess I've just got a heart for servitude. I like serving people.
Yeah.
You know, I still struggle with when people say, "Oh, you're such an inspirational guy." And I'm like, nah. Inspirational is like Stephen Hawking. Inspirational is this, that. But, you know, I guess you don't sort of identify with your own story for that. I don't see myself as inspirational. I've been through some tough times. I've been up and down. I'm very blessed to have the life that I've got, despite the life that I lived before.
Yeah.
I'm in a position of trust. Not just within my family, but within my town and within my community and church. I I guess I it's all about giving back.
Yeah.
For me, or pay not even paying it forward. I hate the expression random acts of kindness.
Yeah.
I don't think it should be random. I think it should be just kind.
Should be just doing it. Absolutely.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It should become part of our sort of daily routine.
Yeah.
To be kind to people.
Costs nothing.
It doesn't, but mentally it does sometimes. You know.
We know, mate, don't we? There's people out there who take advantage of kindness, they sort of use and abuse that situation. But you shouldn't be deterred from that, from carrying on being that nice person. And when you say you don't feel inspirational, it's quite strange because I never used to feel inspirational, mm-hmm. but now I enjoy the accolade of that, of people saying that, you've inspired me to do this. What it means is, for me, I've just impacted their world a little bit. I've either been the turning point or that little trigger that just says, actually, you know what? I can go and do something different. I can be someone different. I can think differently. And so it's not really an inspiration. It's just more of a trigger, a little, a light bulb moment for them. So they use the word inspiration. And for me, I think you are, because of the work you do. You are an inspiration. But it's not about you're the inspiration. It's actually you just giving them that little element of power they needed to change whatever their situation is. So start embracing it, embrace that feeling, because once you embrace that feeling of, this is not about, oh, look at me, I'm inspirational, but you embrace that, actually, you know what? They've basically said thank you. By saying you're an inspiration, they're saying thank you, and you, as you've just done there, you've got to nod and go, you know what? That's great. I'm going to move on to the next one. And someone else says thank you, and then someone else says thank you. You know what? That's quite enjoyable.
It is. And it's addictive as well. To be
honest,
I love doing these videos. Like I said before we started, who else would sit out in their garden shed in -4 conditions, at night, talking to people over the internet? I adore doing this. It gives me I guess it just adds to purpose. I believe that it's God-given. There were people that I'm part of this thing called the School of Supernatural Life, which the idea originated from Bethel, but in Redding, California, but our leaders sort of brought it into the church, and it's about living a life that is supernaturally natural, but naturally supernatural, and listening to God and just living a God-led life.
Yeah.
And I had people coming up to me, and I've done about 6 or 7 years now on the course, helping out. I've done the course 2 or 3 times as well. And thank you to my church, because I've not paid a penny. They've always been really supportive of me there. I've had people come up to me with prophecy saying, God's going to give you a new purpose. I wanted to be an actor, hence the accidental journalist. I wanted to be an actor, and I was pursuing being an actor. And then I fell into journalism, people telling me that I was going to be a voice for the voiceless and give a voice to people that wouldn't, may not have the strength to do that, and it would give them courage. And here I am. The next book will be out hopefully the end of next month.
Brilliant.
Still got a few more bits to put in there, but I help the marginalized.
Yeah.
I'm not about, I could write books about me, and I've done that. I did that, my first book, and I will talk about me in some way, my experience, because it matters. But to give that voice to those that need it it's such an honour.
Yeah.
It's such an honour. And to get recognised for that, you know, I don't just get recognised, I get crap for it as well because of the subject matter that I choose.
Yeah.
You know, who else is going to go after the human traffickers and the wife beaters if I don't?
Yeah.
There's not many people that have the heart to stand up and say that on a public forum.
Yeah.
Because I was a selfish man, and I'm not like that anymore. Because God, you said something that stuck with me was when you said that you were on the stretcher and you were outside the ambulance.
Yeah.
Looked up at the sky and it was just this brilliant blue, and all you could see was the stars.
Yeah.
You thought you were dead. I think when we go through something like that, a part of us does die.
Yeah, possibly, yeah.
And that's the ego.
Yeah.
Because we know we're not invulnerable. We know that we're only one step away from death. And we know we're blessed.
Yeah.
You know, for me, it's where I met God. For you, it's where you started on your journey. And you know, you're here and you are an inspirational guy. And you know, I love your book. Such a great book. Let's skip to the good bits.
You know. I've got when I talk about the book, right? This is one of the things that when I wrote the book, I didn't really know what I was doing. I didn't know why I was doing it. And I'm glad, because I think if I'd have had a motive, i.e. I want to help people or I want to achieve this, I don't think I would have wrote the same book, because I've been second guessing myself. Was actually all I'd done was just poured the story out, you know, and gave it my heart and soul. And the amount of people that say to me when they're reading it, this is not necessarily people that know me, but they can hear me telling the story. And so I'm glad I didn't have a motive. I'm glad I didn't know what I was doing at the time. So that the next book, when I do write the next book, which will be coming, I've got two books in mind. One's going to be a coaching book. The other one's going to be the next level, if you like, of story. Is that will have a motive. It'll be a positive motive, but it's the right time for it.
Yeah.
You know, it's the follow-on from the original.
Mm.
You know, and as you were saying earlier, I think we are, I'm grateful for where I am now. I'm very, very grateful. I appreciate everything I've got. You know, there's not many days that go past now without me just, you know, having a look around, the fact that, you know, we're talking on a computer, you know, the fact that, I've got a house, I've got a car, I've got jobs, my family are doing well. You know, I'm grateful for all those things now. And, you know, financially, I'm doing okay. I mean, I'm never going to be a millionaire. I spend too much and give a lot of it away. But, you know, that's how it is. So, but you know what? I don't need financial wealth to live in the fulfillment I have now. You know, that abundant life that I've got isn't about materials. It's about how I am inside. You know, and I feel good now. And a lot of that is, you know, I'm a massive believer in everything happens for a reason.
Yes.
You know, I do believe that. But quite clearly, we don't know why the reason is sometimes, but it is what it is. And hopefully I'll keep going.
Yeah. We have frozen there, guys.
About it, because it's been in the making a little while, as I know. So do your next book. Tell the world about it, because it's good for you to be writing it, but it's also then going to be good for the people that are reading it, you know. So it'll be an eye-opener, and you know, you're going to be doing good and positive with it. You know, it's done with good intention. You know, you clearly, you know, me and you are not Paul Gascoigne, you know, or, you know, one of the Kardashians. You know, we're not going to be writing this just to make a few quid, you know, or Prince Harry. You know, when we write a book, it costs us money. You know, yeah. We don't make money out of a book, you know. So the only reward we're going to get from a book is if it's impacting people's lives in a positive way.
Yeah.
You know, so But no, that's the we've been waiting to get this little meeting on for a while now, haven't we?
We have, haven't we? It's been a good couple of years down the line.
A couple of years, isn't it? A few years, I think. Yeah.
Since the whole Mr. Bethanator stuff.
Yes. Yeah, the least said about that, the better, I suppose.
Yeah. But then that goes to prove that not everybody in this has the best intentions. And yeah. Some people will use it for their own sort of personal gain.
Yeah, definitely.
I think we've done really well to flesh most of them out.
Yeah, where we can, mate. Yes, he's and like I say, you know, if I can keep doing the good where I am, I'll be happy. You know, I'll be more than happy. And you know, the stuff you do as well, I think will, you know, and the people we mix with now, the circles we mix in, you know, these people now, hopefully, you know, some of the people that I know and I've met through the through Ben Spann, you know, these people have been, you know, not particularly nice people in the past, but they're doing good now. They're using their story in a positive way, you know, completely different to mine. You know, it's in a lot of cases, you know, I've come from a different side of the road to them, but we've all got the same agenda, which is let's go out and make a positive impact on people's lives. Yes, mate. Yes. So that's, I think, well, I've told my story now, and I appreciate the platform, basically. So it's been, you do a good job, mate. You do a very, very good job, and you need to keep doing it.
Thank you, mate. I really do appreciate that.
Yeah.
I will end it up here. If you just stay on the line, we'll have a quick chat afterwards. Guys, this one's been emotional for me, to say the least. It's one that I've waited for quite a long time. And I'm so glad that we were finally able to do it. I will put up links for Darren's book. Really do sort of do think about buying it, because it is just an absolutely beautifully written book. You know, I do say. I shall see you next Monday for episode 4. We've got something special planned for that. And then we've got Chesney Hawks on the 7th of February. So yeah, I shall see you then. As always, thank you for tuning in. I can see the comment section has gone absolutely berserk, so I shall have I shall have a look in a few minutes. But guys, thank you ever so much, and I shall see you again pretty soon. Bye, guys.